welcome to Worlds Apart. Might and power have always been at the center of geopolitics, but over the last couple of decades, and especially over the last couple of months, the definition of what it means to be a powerful or a weak nation has shifted dramatically. In the US-Israeli war against Iran, who has the greatest ability to influence a desired outcome or to sustain damage? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Anousar Farouki, a geopolitical analyst and author of the Policy Tensor Substack. Mr. Farouki, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for having me.
You've been writing about the Iranian war quite a lot, and I think we are at a very interesting junction there because neither side at this point can get exactly what it wants. Neither side can fully trust its allies or disregard its adversaries. And yet all three actors continue behaving as if they were holding all the cards. Do you think that's an effective strategy?
No. This is mostly for show. They are trying to manage public opinion in Washington largely. They are very, very constrained in the possibilities militarily what they can do, all of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking specifically about the Iranian strategy, I think even a year ago, very few analysts would have believed that Iran could resist the combined assault by the United States and Israel for such a long time and with such wide-ranging consequences. How long do you think the Iranians can maintain this type of offensive defense?
The Iranians can prosecute denial far longer than the United States can stay in the conflict. It's the best reports we have of how much of their arsenal is left suggests that they can outlast the United States. If the United States goes back to war against Iran, it is much more likely that the United States will run out of its magazine before it can take out very much of Iran's missile and drone capabilities.
Now, what's fascinating to me is how this conflict has relativized not only power, but also defeat. Because as I said, the United States is still considered the only superpower. And yet you and many other analysts have written that it has lost decisively to Iran. Why do you think that is?
I think that the full import of the new dominance of denial and the new defense dominance because of these precision strike capabilities that have diffused to countries like Iran, the full import of that has not been digested by Western military thinkers and authorities. And now it is as a shock from the Iran war, from the failure of March 2026, it is being understood that this is a much more difficult task, that power projection is much more difficult than it has been in the unipolar world since the Soviet capitulation.
Now, I think many of us can understand why the United States would underestimate Iranian shrewdness and preparedness, but do you think the Israelis have expected such a sophisticated pushback from Iran?
No, I think that the Israelis were even more confident that they had figured out a way of collapsing the Iranian state and that that it was possible for them to do that in concert with the United States. They overestimated their capabilities in terms of how many key personnel they could identify and assassinate. It turns out that states are much more resilient than they thought. And so these are new fantasies about, decapitation that have gained credence in military circles because of the new, transparency that they can see everything from the satellite. So they think that they can affect a lot of political military on the ground, but it's not how it works.
That's a fascinating thing to me because I would understand why politicians would make this sort of make-believe arguments and try to create a narrative that maybe totally removed from reality, but we think that military people, you know, strategists, generals, are usually paid for making very precise and perhaps not always comfortable or enjoyable calculations and predictions. Why do you think the military, both in Israel and in the United States, have proven so, well, negligent, for the lack of a better word?
In my understanding, this has to do with the sort of predominance of air power thinkers in both the United States and Israel, where they have fought this war, inter-services rivalry, for almost a century now, and they are trying to sell this idea and believe themselves that new capabilities make air power much more effective than it has been. But you know, air power has disappointed us for 100 years now, and it's not going to pull our chestnuts out of the fire now.
What do you think are the main Iranian assets that allowed it to last for so long and perhaps keep it very confidently in the fight?
I think that Iran has a very deep bench of human talent. And their capabilities are downstream of that. The missile capabilities, the technical capabilities that they have are downstream from their human capital, which is stupendous. And in many ways, the Western misperception of Iranian power is very similar to Western misperception of Russian power, where people don't understand the scale of Russian technical capabilities and kind of dismisses as a gas station with nukes.
That reminds me of something that I heard you say in another interview, that it's not only miscalculation of the human capital, but of the entire system, the capabilities of a system, because Iran is usually referred to as this draconian regime, and the assumption was that if you just take out the leadership, that the system will collapse. But you have argued that it's far more institutionalized and sophisticated and robust system than perhaps even some of the Western countries can boast.
Yes, so this is a question of the stability of the political order. People have misperceived the Iranian regime as a theocracy, as a dictatorship of the IRGC, as something held by a small number of leaders who are dictating things to the system at large. And that is not how these things function. The Iranians have a very institutionalized regime with very many effective parts that are much more resilient. If you want to think about this, I think a good model for this is Germany, right? You can think that Germany was a Hitler dictatorship. Sure, it was. But that doesn't mean that it was not highly resilient and that strategic air war for 3 years did not completely fail in the German case. And the thing that they think is new is the degree of precision and depth of surveillance intelligence that is available to them, but that doesn't change the fact that the target regime is highly institutionalized and resilient.
Now, you wrote before that while it wasn't clear what the U.S.'s strategic objectives were in the beginning, it is clear now that control over the Strait of Hormuz has become the main aim of the war at this point. Right. How do you think it's likely to be resolved?
I think that there are no military solutions available to the United States to force the Iranians to capitulate in any serious sense. So what they're going to have to do is come to some sort of deal that reopens Hormuz above all as soon as possible and ties Iranian hands in terms of its nuclear intentions. Because the American team, the Donald Trump team, really needs something that it can sell, and what it needs for that is an agreement on the nuclear file. But the difficulty is that the sanctions relief that the Iranians are demanding in exchange is very difficult to obtain from Congress.
Now, I know that you believe that the so-called Hormuz weapon is now more powerful than a nuclear weapon. And in effect, it gives the Iranians not just a veto over access to Gulf energy, but also a veto over the policies pursued by their Gulf Arab neighbors, which I would argue from my side calls for a very delicate, very deliberate handling. What do you think?
I completely agree. I think that the Iranians are sophisticated enough about their statecraft to manage the Gulf regimes in the region, the GCC states, and make them accept Iranian domination of the Gulf, which is de facto not going to go away anywhere. It has been proven that the United States cannot take the Hormuz weapon from Iranian hands, and that military fact is the structuring fact for everything else. So it is very much possible that the Gulf states will play along, and the best signal we have for this is the Saudi diplomacy here, which is they are being very serious, and they are being they understand the situation that the United States can't protect them against Iran.
I do want to ask you about the Israeli statecraft, because it's no secret that the Israeli leadership counted on closer relationship with the Gulf countries to keep Iran isolated. Do you think that's still on the table? And which country do you think, which nation is treated with more apprehension or distrust in the region at this point of time? Is it Israel or is it Iran?
I think that fear of Israel is the dominant factor sort of influencing foreign policies of the states in the region. The Israeli aggression in all directions against all states, they are occupying Syria, they are occupying Lebanon, they have not accepted any kind of constraints on their actions in the West Bank or Gaza. And they have driven the United States into a dramatic war that has cost everybody in the region a great deal. And so it's the fear of Israel is paramount here. And Israeli foreign policy, Israeli grand strategies after October 7th attacks, this unrestrained aggression on all sides is really driving states in the region together into a counterbalancing coalition. The most important thing to watch here is the Turks and the Saudis working with the Egyptians and the Pakistanis. That quartet is supposed to contain Iran, but it's actually the real goal of that is to contain Israel.
I think up until recently, most of those countries looked up to the United States to be a sort of a balancer or an authority in the region and to help solve difficult issues. And I'm not sure if that trust towards the United States is still there. Do you think all those nations that you just mentioned, are they counting on their own policies, on their own cooperation, or do you think they still have the United States at the, on the back of their minds that it will come and do the right thing?
So this perception that daddy will pull out all the chestnuts out of the fire is gone. It's understood now that the United States promises a lot more than it can deliver. But that doesn't mean that the political economies or the political orders in these places are not completely anchored on American hegemony. So the GCC states, above all, the oil monarchies, their entire systems are built on this presumption of American power in the region. So there is a very difficult process by which they must shed their dependence on the United States and seek other security arrangements and different kind of grand strategies that is not so totally reliant on it.
Okay, well, Mr. Farouki, we have to seek one arrangement at this point of time because we need to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
I see you're washing the Moscow mules. And we're gonna brainwash the crap out of you.
Getting word from Red Square.
Who are you? I don't care what my voters say.
I am not a warmonger. I am a peacemaker.
Eating the dogs, eating the cats.
Oggy, there you go. All squeaky clean.
What if everything you think you know is only part of the story?
Bold economic moves, high-stakes battles on the world stage, war and peace, the very future of America.
The headlines are loud. The debates are fierce. Now it's time for a closer look.
Know the policy. Understand the impact. America First with Scotty Nell Hughes.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Anousar Farooqi, a geopolitical analyst and author of the Policy Tensor Substack. Mr. Farooqi, I heard you say before that if this war drags on, China is likely to accelerate its rise. Economic problems in the United States caused by the war are likely to break the MAGA movement, and more countries, more nations will likely distance themselves from the United States. Now, do you see this trajectory as a sort of logical, natural evolution of the international system, you know, the hegemon predictably overstretching itself? Or is it due to more specific, unique factors that are pertinent to this particular conflict?
I think that most of the damage is self-inflicted. I think that without the Trump administration's innovations, the American relative decline could be much better managed, and we would not, for example, we would not have found out that Iran is going to run the Gulf and destroy the American position in the Middle East. If they hadn't done this, they could have kicked the can down the road, and we would not have had to face the crisis American hegemony in the way that we're doing. I think this, a lot of this is self-inflicted. It's not natural transition of the international system in a meaningful sense. But that being said, when great powers like the United States go into decline, they are likely to do crazy things as it's doing. It's not entirely unexpected either.
You know, I'm an avid psychology student, and I think it's a consistent pattern in psychology that narcissistically driven people tend to orchestrate their own demise simply because their systems become very rigid, very repetitive, and not quite capable to adjust to the changing circumstances around them. I wonder if that could be applied to national systems as well, in this case, the United States.
Right. I would think about it much more specifically about the buildup of foreign policy discourse around Washington, D.C., what is called the blob and the lobby and so on. The entire sort of world of like thousands of people talking about and selling some ideas about attacking Iran, for instance, was a world that kind of was tolerable in the unipolar era. That world is now gone, but these people still haven't made their Bayesian updates, if you will.
Now, this revelation brought about by the Iranian conflict that the king or the hegemon, I'm talking about the United States here, is naked or at least embarrassingly exposed, I suppose it must have some consequences for the entire international system. What do you think they are likely to be?
So the most important takeaway from this situation, from March 2026, is the vulnerability of U.S. bases. If the American bases near Iran are so vulnerable as they have proven to be, Iran has been able to strike them at will and destroy so many U.S. assets, then the American bases near other great missile powers like China are extremely exposed, and they are not likely to survive the first few days of conflict. And that really constrains American force posture globally and what it can do and where it can throw its way around and where it can project power. And I think these new constraints on American power projection, the new constraints have still to be recognized. They are in the process of recognizing them. But there's, you know, the really sharp ends, the ones closer to the frontier, Rao fully understand the implications of base vulnerability.
You have written before that the U.S.'s authority in the world has visibly declined, especially among its putative allies, and many nations are subtly or expressly distancing themselves from Washington. Do you think this estrangement is permanent, or is it more sort of reflexive flight reaction that may be reversed once the dust settles and maybe Trump is out of the White House?
There is an aspect of this that is permanent, which is that a lot of states need to figure out a way of securing themselves without the American Unipol. In particular, the Europeans are now fully committed. They now understand that the United States is leaving Europe, so they are going to make their own arrangements. But that does not mean that people are expecting the United States to just go away or become a completely rogue actor. It's a perception that, you know, maybe with the next administration or maybe even with this administration, there will be a return to rationality and a return to the United States as a protector of powers instead of, you know, trying to take a Greenland or something. You know, so there is a perception that that this is idiosyncratic, that the Trump administration is especially crazy, and that the United States might return to a more rational foreign policy. But that doesn't mean that they are not making their own arrangements, especially the Europeans. So everybody has new plans in light of the constraints on American power and in the unpredictability of American foreign policy.
You know, what I find very interesting is while the rest of the world is visibly apprehensive of the U.S.'s impulsiveness, the two other great powers, namely China and Russia, are steering clear from openly criticizing the Trump administration, even though I think it's pretty obvious that they find the American way of operating highly destabilizing. If you were in Moscow or in Beijing, I wonder if observing Washington undermining itself in such a way would be more a cause for celebration or for grave concern.
I think that there is a definite celebration in Beijing and Moscow. I think that they understand that the United States shot its own foot. And in the Iran war, no doubt, they are clapping behind the scenes and cheering and opening the champagne. Once it was clear that the United States was facing strategic defeat, there is no doubt in my mind that they were popping champagne in Moscow and Beijing.
I think it's like a meme among Western analysts that people in the Kremlin are popping up the champagne, because I can tell you from working there, they don't actually drink while they're working. But even if it's perhaps funny or, I don't know, gratifying to see the United States make such obvious mistakes, I wonder if it's also pretty dangerous to see such a powerful nation to behave in such a crazy, and I'm not using, like, I think that's a, you know, statement of a fact, such a crazy, dangerous, precarious way, and not calculating the consequences. Because if they attacked Iran, such a powerful nation, you know, who knows what they're going to do next?
Yeah, so the unpredictability and the impulsiveness and the wildness of the, you know, the superpower going rogue is not pretty, and everybody's scared of what they're going to do next. I think that from the perceptions of the rivals in Beijing and Moscow, there is both worry about the ramifications of the innovations that are coming out of Washington. But there's also, like, they are winning. China is going to sell 10 times as many electric vehicles as it thought it was going going to last year because of the shock from hormones and from the Gulf. The constraints on Russian selling their oil and energy have been completely removed because of what has happened in the Gulf. So there is a material gain. There is a strategic gain, there's relative gain in influence and power by the rivals. But at the same time, they are extremely worried about the shocks to the system from the rogue superpower.
Absolutely. Now, I think we both would agree that the generals and military strategists around the world are watching the developments in the Iranian war theater very closely. And one immediate conclusion that you also wrote about is that medium-sized powers can make war prohibitively expensive for great powers. Now, is that a new given? And does it apply to all great powers or specifically to the United States?
No, I think this has nothing to do with the United States per se. I think that denial has become much easier. And so offense has become extremely difficult. Defense has become much easier because of new technical innovations, because of political development, because of modernization of smaller states, medium-sized states. So it's become very difficult to oppress them and dictate to them. And this is a very general development, and every great power has to recognize the limits of its own power when it comes to smaller states that want to resist its will, because it's going to be very costly to impose your will on even a medium-sized power. Like and think about a clash between China and Vietnam. If the Chinese think it's just going to be a walkover, they're in for a surprise as well, you know?
Well, the reason I'm asking this question is because I'm not convinced it applies just as fittingly to, let's say, the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. Sure, the Ukrainians have been able, especially with the use of drones, to slow down the Russian advance, but I'm not quite sure that they have been able to reverse the trajectory. And I'm not quite sure that any conflict between China and some medium-sized country would put Beijing on the defensive just as easily. And I wonder if that has something to do with, you know, different ways of using great power, because I would suppose that both Russia and China are not applying it in the same way as the United States. What do you think?
The military contingencies one needs to think about, China and Taiwan and India and Vietnam and so on, those are very different from the military challenges faced by Russia and Ukraine. In Ukraine, it has already been extremely costly and difficult for the Russians to get their way and just take the territories that they had declared that they had annexed. The Ukrainians need a cost exchange ratio that is unlikely, that is too rosy to be realistic. So the war of attrition, we understand how this works. The weakest side gets ground down and ultimately cannot field enough forces in the field to stay in the fight. And so this is a grinding, very long-lasting, grinding, costly process, this war of attrition. So no great power really wants a war of attrition. Like, this is something that that you try to avoid at all costs. And certainly wars of choice are not something that can be, no great power would elect to attack another state if it knew that it was going to take 5-6 years to grind it down and you're going to lose hundreds of thousands of men in the process.
Mr. Farooqi, let me ask you one last question about drones. They played a very important role both in the Ukrainian and Iranian conflicts, in part as a tool of forcing adversaries to try to counter them with far more expensive and sophisticated weapons. But I think it's also pretty evident that drones alone cannot substitute for other types of weaponry. So my question to you is, how do you see their place, their niche, within the wider arsenal of modern warfare?
I think the drones innovation, especially the sort of in the cauldron of the Ukraine war, right? The drones are an important new part of the modern battlefield, but they don't change the underlying structures and the military facts around this. For example, even today, most people are being killed by artillery fire in Ukraine. So the drones are important to understand how the two sides are competing, and one should obviously expect formidable use of drones, as we are seeing, for example, in Lebanon, right, where the Hezbollah is using FPV drones innovated by in the Ukraine war. And we're going to see more and more of this, but that doesn't change the fact that military power is not simply about some weapon. It's not reducible to that. Much larger structures are in play. And the important thing to understand is the diffusion of capabilities. Military capabilities are diffused very far and wide. So Israel's going to get its nose bloodied in Lebanon just because, you know, they thought that Hezbollah was gone, that it was defeated, right? But turns out that it's not. It's a very formidable actor, and it's going to extract a very heavy cost from the Israelis. So I would warn against an obsession with a particular weapon or a particular new technology. I don't think that these things are as important as people think they are. Of course, you know, they have a role, and they're not every war is going to have lots of drones, of course. But that doesn't change the fact that other larger military developments are not in play. Even without drones, this would have denial would have been very effective. You know.
Okay. Well, Mr. Farooqi, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your analysis with us.
Happy to join. Thank you so much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.